From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters. Life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Dr. Richard Weikart, Emeritus Professor of History at California State University Stanislaus and author of Unnatural Death, Medicine's Descent from Healing to Killing. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Richard Weikart in their conversation.
Yeah, the Hippocratic Oath not only forbade assisted suicide, which we're talking about today, but it also forbade abortion as well, and was really considered the norm among physicians in the 18th, 19th, and on into the early 20th century. And physicians, to be sure, have been fairly resistant to assisted suicide. There's a minority who have come on board with it. And in the countries where it's sort of most advanced, the Netherlands and Belgium, it does seem that a majority of physicians are on board. But on the whole, in Britain and in the United States, the medical associations have been negative toward euthanasia and assisted suicide for the most part. I mean, the American Medical Association, for example, is still opposed to euthanasia and assisted suicide. Now, the California Medical Association, they went neutral on it before 2016, and it was voted on in California. So that's changing some. But the medical profession has actually been a little more resistant, certainly than a lot of other sort of secular thinkers and in other fields.
You mentioned the ancient Greeks when you were talking about the Hippocratic Oath. Talk about the ancient Hebrews. What was their perspective on euthanasia?
Yeah, of course, they didn't have euthanasia as we're thinking of it today. But when we think about the issue of suicide, which relates to this, if you look at the Old Testament of the Christian Bible, which is, of course, the Hebrew Bible, suicide is almost always presented in a negative light. There's no out-and-out prescription of it, that, you know, they're not forbidding it anywhere in Scripture except for "and thou shalt not kill," which many people would argue, and I agree with this as well, would apply to killing yourself. So I think the Ten Commandments, "you shall not murder," does forbid killing yourself.
It includes self-murder.
But it didn't explicitly say that. So some people will say, you know, think they got wiggle room there and everything. But if you look at the suicides that actually happened in the Old Testament, almost all of them were people who were morally evil. They're not good characters. They're not godly characters that are killing themselves, typically. One of the closest ones to maybe godliness, if you want to think of it, is Samson. But yeah. Samson, of course, was there because of his moral failures. That's why he was in the situation in the first place. And when he so-called committed suicide, he wasn't doing it with the purpose of trying to kill himself. He was trying to avenge his enemies in doing it. So it wasn't just a matter of, oh, I'm just going to kill myself because I'm in pain here, or being, you know, my eyes plucked out or whatever. So that's not presented in a favorable light either. You know, again, Samson was there because of his moral failures. If you look at situations where people were in extreme distress, like Job, you know, Job rebukes his wife when she suggests that he take the route of suicide. You know, she says, "Curse God and die." And Job says, "You know, no, yeah, you, can't we receive, if we receive good things from God, can't we also receive evil?" You know, at the same time. And so Job was, and Job, of course, is commended in the New Testament also for as a man of patience and endurance. And that is the model that's given to the Jews in the Old Testament and also in the New Testament for Christians as well. The model for Christians is to endurance in the face of suffering and trying to find God's way in that path of suffering. If it's chastisement, then to endure the chastisement. If it's for some other cause, like Job's cause, that you endure it. And God, obviously in Job's case, God rewarded him in the end for enduring the suffering that he went through. One thing we never see in either the Old or New Testament is someone committing suicide because they were ill. That never happened. There's no case where that ever happened. You have, in the New Testament, you have Judas committing suicide. But again, that's because of moral failure and because he betrayed Jesus. And obviously, Jesus lamented that it would have been better for him if he'd never been born because of his betrayal and then also his suicide as a result of it. So, and in the New Testament, although it doesn't out and out state, you know, don't kill yourself, it says your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit, which is given to you by God, and says those who destroy the temple, God will judge. So that strongly implies, you know, that you're not to harm the body that God has given you, and thus makes clear that we're not to be committing suicide.
Yeah, and something that you point out, we've talked about the ancient Greeks and the Hebrews, but you also in your book talk about the Renaissance, sort of a rebaptism in the baptismal font of paganism. When the Renaissance takes place, attitudes towards suicide start to evolve as well.
Yeah, and that's, again, because they're going back to the word Renaissance, of course, means rebirth, and is a rebirth of ancient Greek and Roman attitudes and ideas, and people were reading a lot of the writings of those times, ideas about the Stoics. The Stoics were a philosophy that was very popular among the ancient Romans, and the Stoics were very pro-suicide. They very much thought that a person, once they reached the point where they no longer had any abilities to, enjoy their life any longer, that they thought they should commit suicide. So the Renaissance was a rebirth of these Roman and Greek ideas, including the Stoics and others. And so they began discussing and writing about some of the suicides, in fact, of the ancient Romans, and really glorifying them. A lot of the people in the Renaissance were not yet willing, because of the influence of Christianity, they were not yet willing to come out and overtly say, you know, we're promoting we're promoting suicide. But they did begin glorifying some of the ancient Romans who did commit suicide. And so in this way, you're right, the attitudes did begin to creep in at that time during the Renaissance period in the 15th, 16th centuries.
So someone might ask, what's the relevance of writing in your book about history? Could it be that if we don't know history, we're resigned to repeating history? So it's very important to understand what happened in the past so we can see exactly what's maybe taking place in our own context.
Sure. You know, I think, and it's good, I think, to be able to compare the ideas and see how they've changed over time as we're going through. And I think in looking at as I look at the Greco-Roman context and how they dealt with issues like assisted suicide and also infanticide, which I discuss some there too, because they were very much supportive of killing infants, especially with disabilities. But basically, parents had the option to kill their infant, you know, under any kind of circumstance. There was no penalties for that. They called it exposing them because they usually would just leave them out in the fields to either be devoured by a wild animal or to die of dehydration. But I think it's useful to compare the attitudes of the people in the ancient world, say there, with the Jewish and Christian attitudes of the time to see what the difference is and how the worldviews differed on the whole. And once again, being a Christian myself, you know, it strikes me that, you know, the Greeks and the Romans, even though they believe in gods, they believe in a lot of different things, they did not have the idea of the humans being created in the image of God, which the Christians had. And again, I do think that there are a lot of people in other cultures, and again, I haven't done extensive research in a lot of these other cultures, but I do think there's a lot of people in other cultures who do have that sense inside themselves, because God's given us a conscience. God's given every one of us a conscience, whether we're a Christian or not. Sometimes that conscience is misguided and dead and, you know, other kinds of things, but he's given us a conscience. And so I think a lot of people understand the value of human life, but Christianity has a reason to support the notion that human life has value. And that's why I move into the 19th century and 20th and start showing the impact of secular thought and the way that they undermine the notion that human life has any value, this is then what leads us into this notion of that euthanasia and assisted suicide is permissible. Now, it's interesting that there are some people of liberal mindset who do reject euthanasia and assisted suicide, and sometimes they even try to back away from the religious dimension to it. But I think that's maybe misguided in some ways, because again, without the religious underpinnings, you know, if there is no God, if there is no morality. Essentially, if there is no God, and then morality has just evolved, which is what a lot of Darwinists believe and such too, then why not? You know, just end your life. You know, what's the big deal about it? It's another event in the universe, just another chance event that took place, you know, with all the other chance events that are taking place in the universe. But Christianity shows us that there is something distinctive about humans that gives us value, that gives meaning and purpose to our lives, and that even gives meaning and purpose to suffering, which is one of the issues here too. Because again, most people think that I'm going through the suffering. Oh, it's horrible. You know, I can't go through the suffering. It's awful, and I just can't take it. And so I got to just end my life to get rid of the suffering. Which, by the way, if there is an afterlife, they may have more suffering ahead of them anyway.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with historian Richard Weikart. Professor and author Nancy Piercy says, in all his writings, Richard Weikart tackles the most controversial issues, and in this new book, Unnatural Death, he takes on euthanasia and assisted suicide. The only way to stand effectively against a harmful social trend is to first understand where it came from and how it developed. We must identify the cause to apply an appropriate cure. That's why Weikart's careful historical analysis is so needed in our day. To receive your copy of Unnatural Death, Medicine's Descent from Healing to Killing, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org.
Truth Matters, Life Matters More by Hank Hanegraaff is essentially two books in one. Because Truth Matters, Part 1 equips Christians to defend the essential truths of the historic Christian faith. In Part 2, Hank explains why life matters more and how we can experience the height of human existence, union with God in Christ. Simply put, the map is not the territory, the menu is not the meal. We cheat ourselves of authentic union with Christ when we elevate the message above the Messiah. Truth Matters, Life Matters More is a modern classic and the magnum opus of one of the great theological minds of our time. To receive Truth Matters, Life Matters More, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift in support of the life-changing work of the Christian Research Institute. That's 888-7000-CRI, or go online to equip.org.
Dr. Eben Alexander's wildly popular near-death experience book, Proof of Heaven, assures us that no matter what we do in this life, only unconditional love and joy await us in the world to come. But our Lord warned that while the gate to hell is wide, the road to it broad, and those who enter through it are many. The gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Your generous support lets Hank Hanegraaff and CRI speak out against the lies that lead to hell. In appreciation for your gift today, we'll rush you Hank's book, Afterlife, What You Need to Know About Heaven, the Hereafter, and Near-Death Experiences, filled with answers to your questions about life after death. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now. Again, that's equip.org. let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, historian Richard Weikart, in their conversation.
Christianity shows us that there is something distinctive about humans that gives us value, that gives meaning and purpose to our lives, and that even gives meaning and purpose to suffering, which is one of the issues here too. Because again, most people think that I'm going through the suffering. Oh, it's horrible. You know, I can't go through the suffering. It's awful. And I just can't take it. And so I got to just end my life to get rid of the suffering, which, by the way, if there is an afterlife, they may have more suffering ahead of them anyway, but they don't believe that, of course. But Christianity gives a reason to endure suffering as well, and to shows a meaning even in suffering. Not that suffering is a good thing for a Christian. You know, death and suffering are the result of the fall, the result of evil, but God can use them for good purposes. And we see that again in the book of Job. We see that in a lot of other episodes. Well, Jesus' life himself, the most obvious one, you know, Jesus himself goes through suffering and death for our sakes.
Yes, he does. And, you know, as you're speaking, I can't help but think back to my own experience. I was born in the Netherlands in 1950. We immigrated in 1953. My father, a very committed Christian, towards the end of his life, had a fibrosing of the lungs that encroaches upon your ability to assimilate oxygen. And I still remember vividly, he was 74 years old, same age as I am right this minute. I was having this conversation when he was exactly the same age I was. He was 74, I'm 74 now. But anyway, back then, I think it was 1997, I watched him suffer, Richard. I watched the agony that he was going through just to get a gulp of air. And I remember asking him, Dad, wouldn't you just like to go home and be with the Lord? And I'll never forget what he told me. He said, no, every moment is precious. And so the very value that you talk about, the value in suffering, he was expressing to me with those words.
Yeah, and that's very interesting, because a lot of people, when they get in those situations, again, it is, I want to be with the Lord. I want to, and there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. There is nothing wrong with wanting to be released from suffering. Of course, we want to be released from suffering. No one likes to suffer. But you're right. It's amazing how the attitudes have changed in our culture to where, you know, suffering is the absolute worst thing that can happen, whereas we don't think about eternity. We don't think of it in reference to eternity these days. You know, you're talking about your dad. My mother-in-law is living with us right now. She's 91 years old. She's got dementia. And I'm sort of a primary caretaker in a lot of ways. I get up at night with her and do different things with her and everything. And you think, well, what's the purpose? What's the meaning of her life, you know, in this time? And yet, you know, that's not our call. You know, that's not my decision to make, you know, when her life is going to end. I am called to be a servant. I'm called to, you know, be a blessing to those, and, you know, those people with disabilities. And what strikes me too, and, you know, in this whole conversation too, is that, you know, there's a lot of people who seek after assisted suicide and euthanasia, not just because of the suffering and pain. Sometimes, you know, that is an issue there, but a lot of times it's because of the loneliness. It's because of lack of relationship with other people. And some people who do this will actually say this forthrightly. Others times they don't necessarily say that, but it becomes clear from the data. I mean, Oregon keeps data on, they poll people who request assisted suicide, and they keep data on why they request assisted suicide. And a lot of times it doesn't have to do with pain. Less than 50% of the time does it have to do with pain. So this is not just an issue of pain. It's an issue that has to do with human relationships. It has an issue to do with, really with love. You know, the people are lacking the love in their life that they need. And a lot of times if they had that love, you know, they would be willing to go through that suffering. But without love and without connections and things, it just torments them even more, and it just drives them in ways that are unfortunate.
Yeah, when you talk about your mother-in-law, I can't help but think that you can't see necessarily the purpose of that suffering she's going through with dementia. My mother was also afflicted with dementia towards the end of her life. She died at 93. But in taking care of someone in that circumstance, you are changed. The caretaker, the caregiver, is changed. My brother was the primary caregiver because he lived in the same locale, same state with my mother. And I can tell you, he was irrevocably changed for the better. He was a great person at any rate, but he was irrevocably changed for the better through that experience. It is life-altering and in a very positive sense. In the context of the discussion, at least somewhat in the context of the discussion, talk about utilitarianism.
Okay, utilitarianism was a philosophy that came about in the 18th and 19th centuries and is still pretty prominent today. Peter Singer, whom I mentioned a little bit earlier, who has an endowed chair at Princeton University, considers himself a utilitarian. The utilitarian philosophy was a philosophy that pleasure is the highest good. Essentially, it was going back, it was sort of recycling in some ways the Epicurean philosophy from the Greeks, which saw happiness or pleasure as being the highest good. And so usually they will justify morally whatever they think promotes the what they call the greatest happiness for the greatest number. That was a term that Jeremy Bentham, who's considered the founder of utilitarian philosophy. But again, it goes back to he was influenced by Epicurean philosophy from the Greeks as well. But Bentham said that what is morally permissible, was morally good is what promotes the greatest happiness for the greatest number. And by happiness, he meant pleasure, physical pleasure. So, and this is, again, even among people that don't know the term utilitarianism and have never heard of utilitarian philosophy, it's becoming more and more widespread that just whatever causes pleasure is the good thing in life. And that's what we should be striving after, you know, just going after our own pleasures and such. And you can see why that would be appealing to people. Of course, it is appealing because it caters to our fleshly natures, not because it really is satisfying to our spiritual hunger that we have in life. And so, unfortunately, the idea is that whatever causes pleasure is good, whatever causes pain is bad. And so when people have more pain than pleasure, then the utilitarian philosophy seems to suggest that it's probably better for them to kill themselves or to be gotten rid of in one way or another. In fact, just to give you one sense of how this got applied in terms of killing people, Jeremy Bentham argued, although he didn't argue this, by the way, publicly, this was in private manuscripts that Jeremy Bentham wrote back in the 18th and early 19th centuries. Jeremy Bentham claimed that committing infanticide was morally permissible. And the reason that he thought it was morally permissible was because he didn't believe there was any such thing as an inherent right to life or anything like that, because, again, he thought that pleasure is the only thing that counts as being good. And so there's no right life or anything to any human being. There's nothing beyond us. But what he said was that the reason that committing infanticide is morally permissible is because the infant doesn't know it's going to get killed. So it doesn't suffer any pain or fear of pain. You know, you just kill it instantly, you know, as long as you're not causing it pain. He said, you know, you don't torture it or whatever, but as long as you just kill it instantly, he thought that was permissible. And so he said the infant wouldn't feel any pain. The reason that Jeremy Bentham said that killing an adult is not morally permissible is because that would cause fear among people that they might be a victim of that. But the baby doesn't know it, so, you know, it's okay to kill a baby. But it's not okay to kill humans, not because there's any right to life, according to Bentham and the utilitarian idea, but because that would cause fear among people, and that fear would cause pain.
Interesting. You know, we just went through an election cycle, and I've often said that the ballot box is necessary, but it's not sufficient, because our culture is changed by so many other dynamics, including the entertainment industry. And I note in your book, you talk about a movie called The Black Stork. And in this movie, there's this theme that there are times when saving a life is a greater crime than taking a life. I mean, that's an incredible presupposition.
Yeah, and the movie was put out by a physician named Harry Heiselden, who had created a controversy by refusing treatment for an infant that was born that could have been saved. The life of that infant, it seems pretty clear, could have been saved, but the infant would have been disabled. And so he decided not to intervene medically he convinced the parents, you know, not to do anything. And so the infant died. It's called the Bollinger baby case. And so this movie was sort of a takeoff on that, sort of showing his justification for it and sort of putting forth his philosophy out to the world. It came out in the 19-teens, if I recall correctly, the Black Stork did. And it was to try to promote his ideas about how it's better sometimes not to intervene. They had very negative views of people with disabilities, and so the idea was, let's try to get rid of them one way or another.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with historian Dr. Richard Weikart. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of Unnatural Death, Medicine's Descent from Healing to Killing by historian Richard Weikart. Just call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website, equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org.